Lecture 20, The Reign of Emperor Akbar.
In May 1562, 19-year-old Emperor Akbar was napping inside his harem at Agra when he heard an unprecedented disruption just outside. His maddened foster brother and prominent general, Adam Khan, was threatening the eunuch guards with a bloody, unsheathed sword. Moments earlier, Adam Khan had led his henchmen into the adjacent imperial offices where they assassinated Ataga Khan, who was the empire's leading minister and head of a rising rival faction of the young emperor's foster relations. Immediately, many leading courtiers fled the city, terrified of a bloody civil war. Akbar's authorized biographer wrote, quote, "His Majesty was awakened by the dreadful clamor, grappled with Adam Khan, and then struck him such a blow on his face with his fist that the wicked monster turned a somersault and fell down insensible," unquote. Akbar ordered his remaining personal attendants to toss Adam Khan over the parapet. When he barely survived, Akbar had him dragged upstairs by his hair and thrown over again, quote, "headlong, so that his neck was broken and his brains destroyed." Akbar used this traumatic event to empower himself after 6 years under the domination of regent guardians. This truly began the Mughal Empire, which was the combination of this imperial dynasty and various Indian people and cultures. Akbar's father and the family's leading supporters had remained largely oriented towards Central Asia, far less to India. In contrast, Akbar was born in India and remained there throughout most of his life. His longest period away was during his early childhood when he was a royal hostage in Kabul. During Akbar's five-decade-long reign from 1556 to 1605, he and his key supporters created and firmly grounded the Mughal dynasty in North India. We historians know a great deal about Akbar's empire and the people within it. The imperial court and administration produced numerous book manuscripts and voluminous records. Interestingly, however, Akbar himself was illiterate. He was very smart and he had a wonderful memory, yet he could still not read or write. Some later historians have argued that he must have been dyslexic. That would also explain why he ordered portraits of his leading officials, so that he could remember them by face without having to consult a written list. Also, he assigned trusted attendants to regularly read out to him the massive correspondence and detailed accounts that made his imperial administration function so effectively. Indeed, among Akbar's significant reforms was the systematic creation of an extensive and precise paper record archive. These documents have become major primary sources for historians. In addition, there were many scholars at the Mughal court who wrote history books. Most used the tariq genre of historical writing that had long developed in the Persian-speaking world. Akbar himself officially commissioned historians to consult official records. He even directed older members of his household to dictate to scribes their own remembered firsthand experiences of his father and grandfather, emperors Babur and Humayun. Sometimes competing imperial historians describe the same events and policies in strikingly different ways. For example, Sheikh Abul Fazl served Akbar faithfully as his close advisor and publicist. So Abul Fazl's several books represent an idealized depiction of the empire, and they also represent Akbar's policies from Akbar's perspective. In contrast, an aspiring but less successful courtier, Al-Badani, was part of the increasingly disfavored orthodox Sunni Muslim faction at court. Al-Baduni kept a secret history, which described many of Akbar's actions and policies as misjudgments and even heresies. Indeed, the contradictions between Abul Fazl and Al-Baduni reveal some of the tensions present within the empire. Further, There are contemporary descriptions and accounts of the Mughal Empire by people who were living in neighboring kingdoms in India and in Iran. Growing numbers of European visitors described what they perceived in Akbar's empire and court. All these various sources reflect the interests of their own authors and their own cultures. In hindsight, we know that Akbar's reign established the Mughal Empire. However, at the time his father, Emperor Humayun, unexpectedly died in 1556, it was not clear that young Akbar would even be able to gain the throne or survive. Akbar was the eldest son, but he was only 13 years old. And the Mughal Empire was still very fragile and insecure. Remember, Humayun had reinvaded India only 7 months earlier to reestablish his reign after 15 years in exile. Fortunately for Akbar and the Mughal Empire, Humayun's most powerful general, Bairam Khan, remained Akbar's loyal regent during his first 4 tumultuous years of his reign. While Bairam Khan governed, teenage Akbar spent much of his time hunting, personally fighting against bandits and rebels, and maturing through his teens. But gradually, rivals of Bairam Khan inflamed Akbar's growing resentment against his regent's paternalism. By 1560, these rivals had convinced Akbar that Bairam Khan must be displaced and exiled to Mecca. But on his journey out of India, he was assassinated. Next, 2 rival clans each claimed regency over Akbar for themselves. But when Adam Khan killed his rival, and then Akbar executed Adam Khan, this decapitated both of these clans. So the still young emperor finally had the opportunity to throw off regency and assert his own rule. For the next 4 decades, Akbar ruled autocratically. He victoriously led expanding Mughal armies that remained almost constantly at war against his ambitious relatives, rebellious imperial officials, elite and popular uprisings, and neighboring rulers. Akbar invaded any nearby kingdom that appeared weak. But to be victorious, Akbar had to build an effective and secure imperial foundation. Overall, he built the empire through a complex synthesis of Central Asian Sunni Islamic and diverse Indian, Hindu, and Muslim ideas, cultures, and peoples. In order to examine Akbar's dramatic, nearly half-century-long reign, we should highlight 3 types of the many innovative policies that he devised and implemented. First, Akbar drew many Hindus, especially royal clans of Rajput regional rulers, into his administration and army. He married many Rajput brides. He employed their kinsmen and other Hindu warrior communities. And he generally reduced the sanctions and discrimination against Hindus that had characterized most Muslim regimes in India up to that time. Second, Akbar and his close advisors transformed and expanded the imperial administration. They created a single hierarchic system out of the previously diverse and divided high officials, who were then funded by a more efficient land revenue system. Third, Akbar created an imperial ideology that drew together very Islamic mystical religions, ideas, and practices, as well as Hindu ones. This new imperial ideology weakened the earlier connection between the imperial family and Orthodox Sunni Muslims. But this new ideology gave Akbar more centralized control. In particular, he created an imperial devotional cult centered on himself. This attracted the reverence of key imperial officials and also many of his Indian subjects, both Muslim and Hindu. These 3 types of programs, with modifications under each successive Mughal emperor, sustained the empire for the next century. Let's look in more detail at each of Akbar's 3 types of policies in turn. But we should keep in mind that they were all created and implemented simultaneously. The initial impetus for Akbar's Rajput marriages and subsequent incorporation of Hindus into his household, administration, and army seems to have come from an aspiring Rajput clan leader, Raja Bihari Mal. He was the beleaguered ruler over the small kingdom of Umbar in today's Rajasthan in western North India. In 1562, Bihari Mal offered his young daughter, Haraka Bai, in marriage to 20-year-old Akbar, who would recently emerge from regency. Now, Akbar already had two Central Asian Sunni Muslim wives. As was customary for his family, one was his first cousin, whom he married at age 9. The second wife, another cousin, was the widow of Bairam Khan, his late regent. For decades, Akbar would continue to make political marriage alliances by wedding additional women from Central Asian and Indian Muslim ruling families. But Akbar's Hindu Rajput weddings were a dramatic innovation. Muslim rulers from previous dynasties had married Hindu brides, but they customarily compelled those wives to convert to Islam. Instead, Akbar combined Islamic and Hindu wedding rituals for his dozen or so Hindu Rajput brides. Plus, he permitted them to follow their own religious practices inside the imperial harem. Further, Akbar recognized their sons as his imperial heirs. Significantly, however, these marriage alliances were not symmetrical. The Mughal imperial family raised all these children as Muslims and never gave any of its women folk as brides into Hindu families. Nonetheless, those Rajput royal clans who willingly gave brides to the Mughal imperial house gained much in exchange. Their sisters and daughters became empresses, and their nephews became potential emperors. Their own menfolk gained prominent positions in the imperial army and court. Also, Akbar recognized the hereditary right of loyal Rajputs to rule over their traditional kingdoms, although under Mughal sovereignty. Thus, loyal Rajputs gained wealth and power, while rival Rajput clans that refused to provide brides to the Mughal emperors suffered. Akbar combined these innovative policies toward Rajput Hindus with other measures that recognized other Hindus and other non-Muslims in the empire as respected subjects. In particular, Akbar ended several taxes and regulations that discriminated against non-Muslims. These included the imperial prohibition on building new Hindu temples. Indeed, Akbar gave endowments of land revenue to some leading Hindu temples and holy men. Akbar also halted the collection of jizya, a special poll tax on non-Muslims that they regarded as discriminatory. Overall, Akbar's incorporation of many Rajputs and other Hindus made the Mughal Empire much more of an Indian empire. With his second major set of policies, Akbar reorganized and centralized the imperial administration. Akbar ordered the leading 1,000 or so official officers into a single ranked hierarchy. Each man received a numerical rank from 10 up to 5,000, called a mansab. This rank could not be inherited. Instead, each man worked his way up through the system of ranks based on how much he pleased the emperor. These mansab holders, called mansabdars, had no fixed term in office and often had very varied careers. Akbar might transfer them suddenly from one post to another, or from one province to another, in response to a new campaign or crisis, or else on the basis of their performance. Once the mansab system was in place, this hierarchy provided the emperor with a finely regulated process for rewarding his most loyal and efficient officers through promotion and for punishing the others. While Akbar's innovative mansab system had many new bureaucratic features, it also contained many personal and patrimonial characteristics. There was no entrance exam, unlike the contemporary Chinese imperial civil service or later European ones. Nor could rich merchants buy their way in. Rather, appointments and promotions were all based on Akbar's personal inspection and superhuman insight about the man's true worth, usually supported by recommendations from high officials whom Akbar trusted. Customarily, each Mansabdar was ritually presented to the emperor at the time of his appointment, and each promotion as well. Each official humbly offered the emperor a gift of submission and received a robe of honor in exchange. These robes were clothes that the emperor had himself worn, and so were infused with his bodily substance. This ceremony, therefore, showed that the official stood symbolically as a servant or even a slave to the emperor, and was beholden and bound to him as a father figure. At the Mansabdar's death, all of his property went to the emperor. Sometimes, the emperor might restore some of it to a favored official's sons. This further increased a Mansabdar's dependence on the emperor's continued goodwill over the generations. These numerical ranks also specified the number of cavalrymen that the Mansabdar was required to recruit and pay for. Those soldiers served him, but he served the emperor. So the imperial army largely consisted of contingents of different sizes under individual Mansabdars that all came together under the emperor's command. By 1595, Akbar had 1,823 Mansabdars, with an official collective obligation to provide for imperial service an estimated 141,000 cavalrymen. Additionally, there were considerable forces directly paid for and serving under Akbar. So Akbar's standing imperial army was one of the very largest in the world at that time. In order to efficiently control the growing land revenues and pay his Mansabdars, Akbar's administration began to survey all the villages in the empire. Officials even measured individual fields and recorded how much tax was due from each. His officials then calculated how to extract as much tax income as possible without overburdening the farmers so that their production declined. Then, Akbar's central administration assigned each Mansabdar the revenue from specific lands. This revenue assignment became known as a jagir. So a Mansabdar ranked 1,000, for example, would receive a jagir that produced exactly the right amount of revenue income for his official salary rank at 1,000. If he was promoted to Mansab 2,000, he would be assigned additional jagirs. One of the major improvements of Akbar's systems was that these jagirs were not permanent. Instead, the central administration reassigned them periodically. That way, a Mansabdar would not be able to put down roots in his jagir. Rather, he would be dependent on the emperor's continued approval in order to receive new jagirs to replace ones reassigned away from him. As a special favor to Rajput Mansabdars, they were customarily assigned jagirs in their homelands. This recognized their ruling status there, although under Mughal imperial sovereignty. Akbar also began to uniformly systematize the administration in each province. He appointed a governor for each province, as well as separate revenue supervisor, military commander, chief judge, and head newswriter. Each official reported independently to the emperor. This created a system of multiple checks and balances, at least in theory. In practice, powerful governors often dominated their provinces with the help of factions who supported them and were also posted there. As long as Akbar remained strong, however, he managed to suppress all challenges to his reign and rotated each official to another province every few years. Akbar also decreed that the official language of his government would be Persian. He chose not the Turkish language of his ancestors, nor Sanskrit of Brahmanic Hinduism, nor any of the dozen or so vernacular regional Indian languages. This linguistic standardization meant that imperial records anywhere could be read by all officials trained in Persian. The many Indian Muslims and Hindus who were employed in the imperial administration as clerks, record keepers, tax collectors, and accountants were therefore all socialized into Persian language and also the Mughal imperial court culture. So these first two sets of Akbar's innovative policies brought diverse people serving in the empire together culturally, with a focus on Akbar's imperial court as the ideal model. During Akbar's early years, he respected the orthodox Sunni traditions of his ancestors. But with his third set of policies, Akbar gradually created a new imperial ideology, incorporating the religions and cultures of his diverse subjects. For instance, around 1575, Akbar built a highly controversial building called the Ibadat Khana, which is Arabic for divine worship hall. This building housed fiery debates among leading religious scholars and leaders over which Akbar arbitrated. At first, Akbar only invited prominent Sunni Muslim scholars. But representing differing Sunni schools of law, they disputed bitterly. Akbar moved among them, listening and also setting contentious questions for them to debate. The inflexibility of some Sunni scholars and the unseemly hypocrisy of others apparently reinforced Akbar's shift from his earlier Sunni orthodoxy and spurred his personal religious search. In 1578, amid a massive hunt, Akbar collapsed in a fit, terrifying his attendants. After regaining consciousness, he suddenly ordered all the thousands of trapped animals freed. He designated the site as sacred. He had his hair shorn, reportedly to enable his soul to escape a death. Akbar's publicist, Abul Fazl, proclaimed this as a transfiguring infusion of the divine spirit into the emperor. Most recent scholars, however, have doubted this supernatural cause. Rather, some explain this fit physiologically, for example, by suggesting that Akbar was epileptic. Others use psychology, arguing that Akbar was undergoing a traumatic inner emotional struggle to reconcile his earlier orthodox Sunni beliefs with his growing crisis of faith and mystical searching. However, no further episodes of this kind were recorded, and insufficient evidence exists for our definitive diagnosis over four centuries later. However, Akbar apparently felt empowered by this experience. He soon added to his many Islamic titles Amir al-Mu'minin, meaning commander of the faithful. This asserted his leadership over the Muslim community and globally. The next year, in 1579, a mazhar circulated at court. This mazhar was a legal document attesting that Akbar had the ultimate power to decide all religious questions as long as his interpretation did not contradict the Quran. All the prominent Sunni religious scholars at court felt compelled to sign or else face exile. Scholars, then and now, have debated the significance of this mazhar and the extent of Akbar's ambition. Some commentators designated this document Akbar's, quote, infallibility decree, implying that he modeled his claims on the concept of papal infallibility. Now, Jesuits at Akbar's court had described this concept to Akbar, although papal infallibility was not yet official Roman Catholic doctrine. Other later scholars argue instead that Akbar intended to be caliph over all Muslims in his own domain. Yet others assert that Akbar was claiming authority over all Muslims globally and was thus rejecting subordination to his rival Ottoman, Safavid, or Uzbek Muslim rulers. Some recent scholars assert Akbar was proclaiming himself the millennial sovereign, destined to preside over a new universal era of enlightenment. Whatever the precise intention of this mazhar, it accorded with Akbar's pragmatic efforts to subordinate the Sunni religious scholars within his empire. Akbar next broadened his Ibadat Khana debates to include learned and holy men from various other Indian religious communities. He listened closely, challenging each speaker's assertion, testing them against his own developing theology, and adopting parts of their ideology where they confirmed or advanced his own. Around 1583, Akbar reportedly ceased performing the orthodox five daily Islamic prayers. Instead, he began publicly worshiping the sun four times daily, and divine light even more generally. Akbar's new rituals may have had multiple sources. The Mongol Central Asian tradition of some of his family's ancestors proclaimed divine luminescence as impregnating the Mongols' mythic mother. Leading Indian Parsis, that is, Zoroastrians, who religiously performed fire worship, also attended Akbar's court. Some of Akbar's Rajput Hindu wives claimed descent from the sun and performed Brahmanic fire and solar worship within his harem. Indeed, Akbar reportedly included in his noontime ritual the recitation of the sun's 1001 Sanskrit names, as some Brahmins and other high-caste Hindus do. Akbar also had an elaborate protruding balcony called a jaroka atop an outer wall of his citadel. From there, he displayed himself daily to his subjects on the ground below, who variously reassured themselves of his good health, savored his latest sartorial fashion, or worshipped him. Akbar's publicist described this as Akbar ritually, quote, bestowing the light of his countenance on the worshippers by giving darshan. Darshan is the Sanskrit term for the auspicious sight that a Hindu deity bestows on his devotees. Among some of his subjects, a public cult for the daily worship of Akbar developed. Furthermore, Akbar appeared very open to learning about certain topics from Roman Catholics. As early as 1579, Akbar had requested that the Portuguese viceroy in Goa send, quote, me two learned priests who should bring with them the chief books of the law and the gospel, for I wish to study and learn the law and what is best and most perfect in it, close quote. In response, the viceroy sent three Jesuits. During their 3 years at his court, these Jesuits diligently but ineffectively pursued their monastic order's usual evangelical strategy for the conversion of the entire kingdom, starting with its ruler. Akbar even commissioned a Jesuit to compose a biography of Christ in Persian that could be read out to him. In addition, Akbar admired European-style art for its unfamiliar perspective and figuration. He had some of his best court artists copy European paintings and incorporate their aesthetic conventions. He reportedly displayed special veneration toward pictures of Christ and Mary, who were traditionally revered in Islam but not considered divine. He learned from the Portuguese about the conquest and colonization of the Americas, hearing from them. Of late years, the Europeans have discovered an extensive and populous insular continent, which they have called the New World. Some shattered vessels have been here driven ashore. A man mounted on horseback was seen by the inhabitants. Mistaking the man and his horse for a single animal, they were overcome by fear and the country fell an easy capture, unquote. Akbar quizzed the Jesuits at his court about an atlas they presented to him. He questioned how the European cartographer could know the names and locations of Indian cities. But Akbar made no practical use of the atlas or of European-style globes that he later received, treating them as curiosities, not new valuable technology. Akbar also recognized the potential of Europeans as military and political allies, or else troublesome adversaries. In 1582, Akbar dispatched two envoys to King Philip II of Spain and Portugal, proposing regular diplomatic exchanges and requesting Arabic and Persian translations of the Pentateuch, Gospels, and Psalms. Akbar's emissaries, however, never got further than Goa. Further, Akbar found unconvincing the Jesuits' insistence on monogamy, even for Akbar, the Trinity, the divinity of Christ, and the low status of the Prophet Muhammad. Ultimately, Akbar frustrated Jesuit expectations for his conversion. But Akbar did not limit his exploration of the cosmos to established Asian or European cultures. Starting in 1582, he experimented in order to resolve the long-standing philosophical debate about whether human beings have an inherent natural language and religion from which all others diverged. He ordered 20 newborn babies purchased from their parents and isolated, fostered by absolutely silent servants. After a few years, Akbar observed that the children had no language or religion at all, concluding, quote, "Learning to speak comes from association. Otherwise, men would remain inarticulate." Akbar also tried interbreeding varieties of animals to observe whether they could reproduce and, if so, to discover the nature of their offspring. He also worked to master alchemic production of gold, an esoteric means of achieving immortality. Akbar searched to find a universal basis for all religions and to unite all religious communities. This became his policy of Suhi Kul, meaning universal peace or tolerance for all. He thus claimed to respect everyone who submitted to him as the perfect man and the universal sovereign. Any who did not submit felt the force of his armies. Gradually, Akbar created a new imperial court culture centering on he himself. Service to Akbar would be the main, perhaps the only way for men to reach their highest virtue. Their own households should be microcosms of his, and they themselves work to become perfect men within them. Reorienting time, Akbar devised a new solar-based calendar called Tariq-i-Ilahi, meaning the divine era, that began with his own accession. This calendar also had the practical administrative advantage, since the annual harvest and thus the revenue cycle varied within the lunar Islamic Hijri calendar that the empire had previously used. Akbar also added Allahu Akbar to imperial documents and coins. Now, this phrase conventionally means God is great, but it also literally means Akbar is God. So the emperor was suggesting his own divine status. Among Akbar's courtiers and household, a special imperial cult developed that centered on him as the universal spiritual master and cosmic sovereign, superior to all other human beings, religious, political, and other. The initiation reportedly involved especially deep prostration to Akbar and repudiating all other religions. Initiates received from Akbar an icon of the sun, a special turban, and a small portrait of him to wear on the head or breast. Imitating Akbar, but going against orthodox Muslim custom, many disciples shaved off their beards. Initiates even stopped using among themselves the conventional Arabic greeting, Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, instead substituting Allahu Akbar, implying Akbar was Allah. This imperial cult bound those initiated to him, overriding their other loyalties, including ethnicity and kingship. Akbar's publicist repeatedly proclaimed him divine light itself, an earthly embodiment of the sacred, the millennial sovereign. But many orthodox Sunnis objected strongly to Akbar's pretensions, although few dared to attack him openly. Over Akbar's nearly half-century-long reign, he and his close advisors combined his victories in war with his three innovative policies: incorporate Rajputs and other Hindus, create an extensive and effective administration, and elevate the emperor to almost divine status that diverse people within his empire could revere. Subsequent Mughal emperors all built on these foundations with varying degrees of success, as we'll see in the next lectures.